Today I'm speaking with John, an insightful and self-possessed orator on the topic of sex offense conviction. John has experience going through the legal system from confession to registry, and with his firsthand knowledge, he's developed a tremendous understanding of our struggles and failures in handling sex offenses. I'm not revealing the nature of John's offense because it isn't material to today's conversation, and it doesn't define him as a person or a commentator. Hi, John.
Hi.
Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today.
Sure. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I want to ask you about your post-conviction experience, and I know we have a lot of points to cover, but I was hoping we could lead off by you giving us a little bit of a history about your post-conviction experience.
Well, my post-conviction experience, or like my
conviction. Let's start with the conviction, if you're comfortable.
Yeah, that's okay. I guess I'd rather start there. I mean, a few days after the crime, I was at work. I was a student at a major university and had police come to my work. I had a university job, actually, and kind of sit me down in this side room and confront me with the allegations. And I just kind of like remember sitting there pretty dumbfounded, because not dumbfounded, but really in shock, and just sort of coming to terms with everything that was just kind of like happening in front of me. And I kind of just made the quick decision to confess and just to kind of tell the truth to the police. I was kind of thinking at the time, you know, they'll appreciate like you telling the truth and just cooperating with everything and just making things kind of go smoothly. I think that's, I had a lot of faith, I think, in like the justice system to like understand kind of what was going on and everything.
And we're trained to, you know, understand that speaking up and taking accountability is the right thing.
Right, right. That accountability, that taking accountability is kind of the right thing to do. And the police were like very nice. You know what I mean? Like that was kind of funny to me. After I confessed, though, I kind of just like went back to this meeting or whatever. And yeah, it kind of like all took control from there. You know, they explained to me, the police dude was like, as the detective kind of left, kind of told me to get a lawyer, like as he was leaving, like really kind of tried to like help me out. I mean, cause you know, he was like, I'm turning this over to the DA, and like, they're going to decide like what happens next. They charged me with a, second degree sexual assault charge, which is a felony, in my state, and has, I think pretty much any state, doesn't have any mandatory like sentencing guidelines, like some crimes would, but does have a mandatory, sex offender registration, for at least 15 years, but the judge can increase it if they want to. I was really pokey on like getting a lawyer. I went through, the sort of disciplinary system at the university too. I was, suspended from school, but the whole proceeding up until, being charged until my sentencing was a year long.
Wow.
Yeah, there was just kind of like little speed bumpy things. And I mean, it takes a long time anyway. I had gotten a public defender and then wasn't happy, and then ended up getting a private attorney kind of halfway through. Didn't end up mattering really. You know, so we were going through plea negotiations, which is really kind of an absurd thing. Like when there is a confession, going through plea negotiations, you know. So the confession was the only evidence that they had against me. You know, there was no physical evidence at all. And so what is kind of crazy to me is, it's not crazy, but when there is a confession, in my mind, that would be, since it's so helpful to the prosecution to have a confession and no physical evidence, I mean, that's like a slam dunk for a prosecutor. So going through plea negotiations, they were offering all these misdemeanors that don't include sex offense registry, and the prosecutor was really not coming down. And it was really interesting, a year after my sentencing, and I signed the plea agreement for the third degree sexual assault charge, And we had to go to a contested sentencing hearing, which means that, so even though we agreed on the charge, the prosecution and the defense were not in agreement about what the sentence should be. They were asking for jail time and 3 months of supervision, sex offender supervision specifically, which is a whole other thing. While we were asking for no jail time and 3 months, or sorry, 3 years worth of supervision.
Wait, can you, what is supervision? I'm not sure.
Probation.
Oh, okay. Probation.
Probation. Yeah. That's just, that's what I guess we call probation. It's same thing.
Okay.
And what was so crazy is the prosecutor sat down at his table and just kind of thanked me, literally just kind of like listed off all of the ways that I made his job super easy, to get, you know, this conviction, which I think that he thought was like, he was kind of being nice, you know,
right.
But was like, a little kind of crazy to me.
Yeah.
I thought ultimately, so I was sentenced to 2 years of supervision and then 4 months jail time. So the judge is not bound by the constraints that are set forth by the prosecution and the defense as far as sentencing goes. So they could have done whatever they wanted to. So they actually came down less on, the judge did, on probation and kind of gave me this like weird like speech as he was sentencing me. About, you know, take this as an opportunity, you know, or whatever. And I so get that, you know, I think that sentencings should be like that. Like they should be turnaround points for people's lives, hopefully for the better.
Mm-hmm.
But what it kind of felt like is that they were kind of having me step into like these cement blocks, you know, take off my shoes and step into these cement blocks, and then have myself pull myself up on my bootstraps kind of thing. So it was an odd speech, but, after the sentencing, I was actually super relieved despite the fact I had gotten jail time and I was going to have to register as a sex offender. Just because the year of waiting just took so long.
Mm-hmm. And just knowing, no matter what the results were, knowing was better than not knowing.
Right. I mean, I think that was like, honestly, like the year, and that's the other thing that's like kind of weird too, is that I was just, you know, out in society for a whole full year. You know, I wasn't on the registry. I wasn't in jail. I mean, nobody thought that I was actually. And I had gone through assessments, you know, sort of like the psychological assessments or whatever. Really nobody involved thought that I was like a threat to people, I guess you'll say.
Mm-hmm.
Which is so interesting, you know, my attorney too kind of gave this, you know, this anti-jail time argument at sentencing that, you know, it's about deterrence, that if he was a danger, you know, it would make sense to kind of put them away. And I think that...
And I will say that yours was an isolated offense, and so it wasn't like mm-hmm. you were a repeat offender. And so I think that was the point your attorney might have been trying to make as well, right? That it...
Correct.
There was, okay.
Yeah, so it was kind of funny. I mean, I started my sentence. I wound up, you know, awaiting jail time. I had to, like, wait, like, 4 months to go to jail. It was, like, really odd. I thought, because that's the other thing, is that nothing really makes sense, you know, of just letting me, if I was a threat to people and people thought that. And obviously, you know, I had been. But I really think that being confronted about something, and again, I had confessed, so I think that I was sort of ahead of the curve on that kind of thing. After once I, you know, got out of jail and went to, I was on probation and was going to sex offender treatment classes, which was like its own kind of funny thing. I mean, you really do see like how far behind people are on accepting kind of the nature of their crimes. But I do think that there is something to be said about confessions.
I agree.
And how, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I mean, I wanted to ask you about confessions actually, because I feel like you've made a point that I think was a valid one about how, our legal process doesn't really incentivize confessions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that that's so true. So when you are in like plea negotiations, first of all, I think even the very idea of negotiations is like a little, I just really don't like it. You know, are you buying a used car or are you trying to like figure out the truth and figure out some justice here? But what negotiations does is just sets up this whole, it's not about like what the truth is. It's about what you can like force the other person's hand into. Does that make sense? And the thing with confessions is, okay, in my view, everyone from like your friend, Jesse Nicholson Getz, you know, a defense attorney to like Jeff Sessions, you know, the most powerful prosecutor in the country would agree that if you can figure out a way to organize political legal proceedings to get people to confess and take accountability for the things that they've done, that would be a good thing.
Right. Absolutely.
You want people to confess. But what happens is that when the stakes are so high, prison time, sex offender registry, blah, 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 all that stuff, just the money too, people are going to lie. Like people are going to lie not because they are just a bad person who just wants to get away with a bunch of things, but because the system sets it up in such a way that when you tell the truth, you are punished, actually. So we like to tell ourselves that you're going to be punished more severely if you lie to us. You know, if you lie to the police, you're going to get found out and you're going to be punished more severely for lying. Mm-hmm. That's kind of a myth that's out there, I think. That's really, I think, is like totally wrong. I think, you know, lying to the police about these things, especially, and not to say, hey, everybody start to lie to the police, but it's pretty easy to, I think we can agree that getting away with these kind of severe sort of crimes is pretty easy. Actually, if like you look at the data and the evidence, that all you have to do, I mean, put them on a wild goose chase and lie to the police. If you confess, especially as within my case and other cases where there's totally no evidence against you, and then they kind of still set you into the same paradigm, like the same rules apply as if you just totally lied and attacked your accuser all over again.
Right.
But the same rules apply.
Yeah. So you didn't feel like because you took accountability right away, because you were honest and you confessed willingly, you don't feel like your sentencing was lighter as a result.
Definitely not. And I know. So yeah, I mean, 4 months of jail time. What's kind of crazy too is, so I was watching after I was on probation. This was like in 2012 when I was on probation, and I remember watching on TV. This is when the trial of George Zimmerman was going on for the killing of Trayvon Martin. Mm-hmm. And as I was just like sitting there, like recounting my year long like experience with the criminal justice system, it was like almost like the almost exact like opposite thing happened, where like he, you know, there was all this evidence against this guy, kind of. Mm-hmm. And he went to trial. He lied. You know, he did all of this crazy stuff, and then goes to trial and then gets a non-guilty verdict. You know, all of that trouble for nothing. And, you know, he just told like this kind of crazy story that didn't align with like much of the evidence I was being presented in court, but still it was like enough wiggle room, I guess, for the jury to acquit him. And I'm thinking, I'm like sitting here watching this. I'm on this like crazy kind of probation. I'm not allowed to use the internet. I'm not allowed to have the smartphone. I've got all the same restrictions on me that is if I'd had like, you know, a bunch of child porn and, you know, molested like six kids.
Right. And which, just for anyone listening, John's offense had nothing to do with children.
Correct.
So I will state that.
Okay. And so, yeah, it was just a little mind-blowing that, you know, when you confess, it really seems like that's like when the hammer comes down, is when you confess. And so they're really disincentivized. And I think that confessions are so important for like getting to the next step of healing, I guess, both for the assailant and for the survivor of the crime. Mm-hmm. Because when you have, when let's say, you know, legal system aside, you know, you have a victim of sexual assault, and then they just hear, no, it didn't happen. No, you're lying. You're crazy. That didn't happen. I mean, it's a whole other kind of attack on that person's integrity now. And, but when there is a confession, the acknowledgement, I think, would be very, you know, people will say that that kind of thing is very powerful, you know, to hear their,
I completely agree. I think that that would offer closure and healing in a way that, you know, various other sentencing guidelines wouldn't. Like the actual, mm-hmm. like, public acknowledgement of what happened to that person.
Yeah, and that's kind of, we, like, love to tell ourselves that that's, like, what we do in open court. Mm-hmm. You know? But it just, like, it just is so far. I think that, like, my personal experience and just kind of, after watching some things and, you know, going back to school and kind of taking more serious look at some of these things, I think it is really incredible the kinds of myths that we tell ourselves about the legal system, that it deters crime even at all, that it's like about public safety. I think that there's like, I think it's hard to show that the criminal justice system is like good for public safety. I think there's some evidence that it's makes things worse, like criminalizing people, putting them in prison, bringing that back out into the community without social ties. You know, criminal behavior is at its core is antisocial behavior. It's people, but then when we criminalize people, we take away a lot of tools from people through putting them through the criminal justice system, labeling people as felons or whatever, making it hard for them to find a job or rent an apartment. Those are only going to enhance antisocial behaviors.
Right. We focus too much on the punitive and not enough on the rehabilitation and reintegration and all of that positive, constructive mm-hmm. work. I want to go back to your sentencing because something I meant to ask you is whether or not you thought that being gay impacted the way you were judged.
The way I was judged?
Or treated in general. Like, how has that influenced things for you?
I think that, like, the biggest... I think that, like, the biggest is not maybe institutional. I think it sort of gets down to, like, the nature of my crime. I think it has a lot to do with, like, why I did what I did. I was, like, closeted at the time and just not... I was not, like, a very, like... healthy state in mind. I was 21 and closeted and just, you know, doing a lot of dumb college things too. And just not dealing with it in the right way. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is probably the biggest impact. I think with like the sentence, one thing I think is it just is like hard to know because again, like I really gave the state just like a open and shut case, like with a confession. So it just is really hard to know. I think that I garnered like a lot of sympathy actually with like the detectives on the case. One thing that I think is so crazy is so I was actually asked to give a blood sample for AIDS testing, HIV testing. I don't think I told you that. Mm-hmm. So I do wonder, I'm like, why was that? Like, is everyone who's being charged with a sexual assault offense being given, you know, mandatory blood testing for HIV, which by the way was impossible for the person to have gotten.
Right.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Nothing. There was nothing that happened where that person could have gotten HIV, even if I had it. I had to pay for it myself too. It was like $300-something, you know, to like get this testing. So I do wonder, you know, what was up with that. You know, I think that there are some people who, I think that some people are more uncomfortable with the idea that the problem of campus sexual assault is like, so is framed in such a way that it is like, aggressive male students and female students, and like, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. With mixed with alcohol. And so, I think that it upsets and unsettles little, people to know that, it was a same sex sexual assault, that I was punished for it. Whereas there's so many, you know, heterosexual assaults, that just go totally unnoticed. So I think I wouldn't be able to say like for sure that there was like this bias from the prosecutor or the judge.
Mm-hmm. Have you felt bias, since like post conviction due to your sexual orientation?
I would have to say no, just because I don't know. It's really hard to say.
Right.
Just on like an individual level, like I am confident that there was a lot of like discrimination in the criminal justice system, among, you know, towards, LGBT people. But, it's just hard to say to me individually. Some people think that there is, mm-hmm. you know, that it is just, I had a therapist one time who, you know, I was kind of explaining it to her, and she was actually, I sought her out specifically because she was, a sex and relationships counselor who actually had found, a lot of her clientele were, sexual abuse survivors that she worked with. So I like sought her out in particular. And I remember like, when I was talking to her about this, she kind of lost her cool, in like the middle of like a session once, because, how many, you know, I probably don't need to talk about this, but you know, she knows a lot of clients who have undergone a lot of things, and the criminal justice system was just nowhere for them. You know,
What do you mean nowhere, you know, for them?
The criminal justice system like did not show up like to find them justice.
Got it.
You know, so they're, you know, whether or not, and I don't obviously know any of like the details or other clients or anything, but, it's so ubiquitous that so many people are assaulted, and that the one, and I know this actually from reporting from a student newspaper of mine, that I am the most severely punished student from that university in the criminal justice system. It didn't have information about like suspension, expulsion, and things like that. But in the criminal justice system, I had the most jail time behind bars out of anyone from my university, which is pretty extraordinary, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if that is because you handed them a confession, and so they just, mm-hmm. you know, it gave them much more leverage, mm-hmm. which to sentence you, which again, mm-hmm. it comes back to that's a great example of how disincentivized confessions in this instance, and in general, I think that's true.
And so I just think that like my biggest issue right now is I think that we really do need to figure out what to do in order to get people to confess to their crimes and just take accountability for what they've done. But when taking accountability means being subjected to just sort of absurd sort of constraints on like your living condition for pretty much like the rest of your life, having just difficulty finding a job or an apartment, and I mean prison time, all of those things, when that's what accountability means, it gets harder and harder for people to take accountability for their actions. And all we ever seem to be able to do is just turn up the heat on people. Whenever we have this problem, we think, well, let's just make it worse for the people that we get. For like the people that we catch, we'll just keep on making it worse, and that will like deter other people from doing it. But that's not what happens. When people are in like the about to commit a crime, no matter what the crime is, nobody thinks that they're going to get caught. Otherwise, right. They wouldn't be doing the thing, you know. But we kind of, again, that's like another myth where it's like you make the cost of crime higher and higher and higher, and that will disincentivize people from doing the crime. But that really has been shown not to work.
Do you think that like therapy should be introduced more in terms of sentencing?
Yeah, it's really It's I do, but I think that the person like really has to be ready for it. That's the other thing too, is that like you can't just kind of. And the other thing is you know, you don't want people to confess to crimes that they didn't do also. But I think with therapy, I think, yes, absolutely. I think that instead of we pump so much money into prisons and like weapons for police and all of these like crime preventive measures that just seem so obvious to us, you know, more prisons and more guns make the world a safer place. Mm-hmm. So I would really like to see the money being redistributed into a place where, you know, yes, more counselors and, you know, more options for the survivors of crime and people who come into the justice system as victims, because they don't, you know, they actually really don't, you know, they don't have representation, actually.
Right.
Right. Like the state does not really represent them.
Yeah, and so, which is it's another reason why they tend to get lost in the process a lot of times, mm-hmm. the victims. I agree. I think that therapy on both sides would be helpful. I think, you know, if we could allocate some of those funds toward, therapy and other types of behavioral healing for the victims. And then, behavioral adjustment programs, whatever those might be, for offenders, I think that might be a little more effective when it comes to, if you want to use the word, rehabilitating people, which kind of brings me to my next question. What was the easiest part about your conviction?
The easiest part of my conviction was, hands down, was the jail time.
That's so crazy to me.
Yeah,
that's supposed to be the worst, scariest, like, you know, the increased jail time, like, that's supposed to be the ultimate deterrent and the ultimate punitive measure.
Yep. And so, but really, jail is, like, dumb. Like, it is super dumb. Like, all you do is you just, like, sit around. It's so boring. Like, I just, so, like, the year when I was waiting sentencing, you know, that was excruciating, because like you just don't know like what the future is like at all. And it was really I mean, I was like, you know, having sort of like a identity crisis, you know, that whole time, because it was just not something it was not a position that I ever thought that I'd see myself in. I don't think anybody does, but, so that was kind of happening. Jail though, it's like you go and like, you don't have to worry about anything. It's like stress-free. I shouldn't say it's like stress-free, because it is just kind of like annoying and the beds are super uncomfortable. But you just like hang out and like read books. And like I did crossword, I saved up my cookies from lunch and traded them for crossword puzzles that this guy brought in who had like a job, you know, and got to leave, you know, and just like stuff like that. But I mean, it's just is so boring. One thing, you know, when I watch a show, Orange is the New Black, which I like quite a bit. And the one thing I was like, you know, the most unrealistic thing about this show is how exciting it is to be locked up. I was like, this show would make way more sense if they just spent 90% of the time, just everyone in their cells, just staring at the tile floor, because that's really what it's like. It's like 90% that, and then 10% like other stuff, literally. And so, yeah. And then after I kind of got out, the probation really sucked, because like I said, I was underneath the same constraints. I was under like the most, there's only one level of sex offender probation, which is everything. And so.
Right. Which is what? No internet,
no smartphone. There was like weird, like you get like these little things at your door on like Halloween, you know. Oh man, I wish I had saved this. But it was like, you know, you're not allowed to decorate your house for Halloween, and you're not allowed to have any costume or part of a costume on the premises.
Wow.
Like what is a part of a costume? What is a part of a costume?
I mean,
anything can be part of a costume.
I just racked my brain to figure out why. Is that because some sex offenders abuse children? And so there's that component? Like, is that the theory behind the costume thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
But and I don't know if there's like a specific incident like in my state that would have or my because it's you know, that's the other thing is that pretty much any legislative body can legislate against sex offender status, meaning that, like the county that I'm in could vote, as far as my understanding, to do to take certain measures about sex offenders. And so could the federal government, and so could my state government. And so all these different actors, you're kind of at their mercy because obviously being a sex offender is not a like protected status. Right. I mean, it's like just the opposite. I mean, so you have this status that just really puts you until you're on, you know, I'm going to be on for another 10 years. And they can just almost do anything that they want. I mean, you could have like legal battles like in the interim to kind of see whether or not these things are constitutional or whatever. But you know, the whole point of the registry is to have identified the bad guys and to like save us from them. Despite the fact of how like ubiquitous sexual assault is.
Yeah. In fact, you brought up this really poignant point when we spoke before this interview, which is, you know, one statistic that is commonly cited is that 1 in 3 women will be sexually assaulted at some point in their lives. And right now we're experiencing the Me Too movement where, you know, women are standing up. I say women, it's men too, but typically right now the conversation is falling along gender lines, so I'm going to speak to that. You know, women or victims are standing up and they're saying, you know, this happened to me too, this happened to me too. And so we're, you know, becoming more comfortable associating ourselves culturally and collectively as victims. But if you raise the really good point, you're like, well, if 1 in 3 women are being assaulted, who is committing all of these assaults? Is it like a handful of serial assaulters running around? Mm-hmm. Or are we the assaulters as well? Like, there are mothers, or there are fathers, there are our friends, there are us. Like, we need to be looking to ourselves in terms of whether or not we are offending, how that's occurring, and just growing more comfortable by taking responsibility personally for the assaults that are being committed.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, the question I kind of said was, you know, who out of 1 in 3 women being assaulted, do we think that it is, you know, 1 in 10 of men doing these assaults? Or do we think it's like 1 in 3, you know, that there's as well? Is it kind of 1 for 1? Or, you know, how common is the experience of being an assailant? You know, we kind of talk about, like you said, like it is a very common experience for a woman to experience sexual assault sometime in her life. You know, a lot of a very, you know, well, 1 in 3, and even we'll just never know. I think even, you know, with people speaking out and new survey things, I think that there's lots of reasons why somebody who survived assault would not want to, or never really do, come to terms with that, or like agree even. Mm-hmm. If you can come to some like objective standpoint, you know. So we'll just really never know. And yeah, I think that assailants, and so when we talk about one of the things of this, that the statistic that you hear from, you know, the survivors and victims' rights advocates is that these women are everywhere, you know, like they're in your, you know, they're your family members, even if you don't know, like they're your family members. They are your coworkers. They are your neighbors, like in your apartment building, they are in your classes. And I think the thing that we need to come to terms with is that so are the assailants. You know, do you know, like, you have got people in your family who have done things like that are like registrable offenses, like felony level sex crimes, who just never, you know, never came to terms with it themselves, like really possibly didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah, I think I would go out on a limb and think like a large amount of assailants don't realize that what they've done has been as offensive as it was. And,
yeah. There was actually a pretty good article on the Aziz Ansari thing. I think it was on Vox.com or whatever about, where the title was, but the article was about like, was something like, I thought I was one of the good guys, you know, who was someone who.
Mm-hmm. Was the title, Here's What's Missing from the Aziz Ansari Conversation?
Maybe. Okay. Probably. I think that they posted a few things, so I'm not totally sure.
Okay, well, what was the.
But he was like, you know, I thought I was one of the good guys, but it turns out, like, I've done a lot of stuff that was, like, eerily familiar to that, mm-hmm. you know? And I didn't really realize how it was coming across or, like, what, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, how it could have been perceived, how it was actively mm-hmm. being perceived by my partner yep. at the time. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I actually know some people who, on the harassment end of things, they've, since the Me Too movement started happening and these accusations have been being made public, you know, I've heard them ask me and ask each other and themselves, like, I wonder if I've ever done something like this. Like, mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Whether or not it's phrased in like, I wonder if I'm guilty, or I wonder if someone would think that I had done something like this, like whatever, just that awakening and that having enough self-awareness in that moment to even ask that question is really important. I think that's a really, really significant part of the movement that's happening right now. And that's what we should be mm-hmm. encouraging.
I totally agree. And the thing I think that like, even that Aziz Ansari, okay. So here's like the thing with that story too. With that guy who said, oh, I kind of realized that I've done things like this before, is he made that realization and came to terms with that, like, without going through criminal proceedings. And that I do think that it is a very good thing that I was confronted with, like, what I had done. And that was told, you know, to kind of, and just to kind of have that like personal awakening, that I really was like not on a good path, that I needed to like, you know, work on a few things. And what is so frustrating in retrospect is that I sort of did everything that like I was supposed, in my view, was like supposed to do after the fact. Like I confessed right away. Like I made it the conviction super easy as, you know, told from the prosecutor himself, I apologized. I served my sentence. You know, everything went fine. I went back to school. I did all the things that one would think would be trying to overcome or just become better.
Yeah,
you know, I think
that
that's
the, right
the thing.
Yeah.
Just doing the right thing and like becoming better. But I'm still being punished for these things just through 101 little things. And so it's sort of frustrating to kind of see people who, I mean, literally I've got, you know, friends who were, assaulted, and in my view, you know, have had worse things. You know, I know like assailants that I know who have done worse things, like to some of my friends, mm-hmm. than like what I think that I did, and not to minimize that at all. But who are just like living their lives, like still like doing kind of the same kinds of things, you know, and who will never see like accountability for that. But I do really think that in order for people to come and for us to incentivize that with the legal system, we do have to kind of put down our weapons a little bit and kind of come to the table and figure out what it is that we want. Like what is going to make the future better? And what does justice mean for people? I think that that's going to be a really important conversation.
Right. And to that end, we spoke about jail time, and then we started to talk about your probation experience mm-hmm. where you couldn't use internet, you couldn't have a smartphone. What were some other realities for you during that period? And how was this over the course of years or months?
It was 2 years.
2 years
that I was on probation. Okay. Yeah, right. Without internet, without smartphone, and like it was just kind of weird. I mean, I wasn't allowed to drink, obviously, or like use drugs. I had to go once a week to visit once a week my probation officer, and then it kind of got moved to like, you know, every 2 weeks or something. You know, I was not like one of their problem people, mm-hmm. I think. And then I had to go to group sex offender therapy on Saturday mornings. And that was like pretty much it. I was working at the thing that's like kind of crazy too is so I was, you know, I was looking for a job, and because I wasn't allowed on the internet, but I was allowed on the internet, like at like the public, you know, like the city's, you know, job center or whatever. So I had to like get in my car and like, you know, I couldn't like go on my laptop in my house and like apply for jobs. I had to drive and it's just so debilitating,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just is like really, it's just is really odd. But yeah, I got a job, for like 2 years. I was living at my dad's house and just kind of like while I was on probation, just kind of going through all this stuff. And it was just, that I just don't think helped me personally at all. Well, I think that I actually do think that the group therapy is, was a good thing for me personally. And I think that it's something that needs to be like way more integrated into, these sorts of criminal proceedings. And it's tricky, but I think that, again, I think that that's something that can work.
Yeah. What was that group therapy experience like?
It was really weird. I mean, it was like super awkward, because so you're kind of in there with, it's like all these guys who've done all these various things. I kind of showed up on the first day and there's like different levels, and I showed up at the most, at the, like the more severe level. And then the therapist, who was like a really, nice, I think conscientious, female, group facilitator, did a really good job with the group. And she was kind of like, oh, you know, you're probably supposed to be in the, or you're supposed to, you know, you're supposed to be in the less severe one, but I'll put you in with the more severe people, since you're here. And it was just really weird. Like on your first day, like everyone goes around in a circle and like explains to the group what they did. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. I think that that is, just such an interesting exercise. Cause like you really can tell almost from the get go, which is like why they make you do it. Like who is taking accountability, like we talked about, who's taking responsibility for kind of their crime, you know? And then, cause you can tell a lot about the words that people use when they describe their crime, and being just like really evasive. And some people, think that it's really unfair that they have to be there, which is usually a bad sign for them. And then it's kind of one of the weird things too, is, you know, people kind of come and then they kind of disappear and you don't really know what happens to them or like whatever. Can't really tell you.
Go on. Sorry.
I was going to say, usually there's just like a different topic every week. And then you kind of take turns. You kind of check in with everybody, see how everybody's lives are going, because it's difficult. That was another component of it, actually, that, our therapist was like very, you know, was okay with, was that like, we've got to talk about like your guys' personal like struggles, like with being on probation and with being on the registry, because like, this is the only avenue you're ever going to be able to talk about that. And it does, suck.
Yeah. And how long did you say you attended that therapy?
1 year. It was like only, it was like kind of like while I was on probation, and like the first year, I'm not totally sure what happened exactly, but it was, I think less than a year that I was there. And it's like a year long treatment. So I technically didn't complete the treatment only because my probation time had ended. Mm. And so I didn't have to finish. I mean, I don't know. In my personal view, I found it like very interesting, actually, the kind of people that were there. And it was kind of like an interesting, you know, human study, you know, yeah. Sex offender treatment class.
Yeah.
I mean, there were some people there who just really employ like the exact kind of language that, gets, victims' rights advocates, you know, all, you know, riled up, is, you know, the kind of she was asking for it kind of rhetoric, except for like clouded up more, you know, like no one says that anymore. But they say, you know, very like similar things, like it wasn't my fault because kind of a thing, you know, like they admit to what they did, like the physical act.
Right.
But just really looking for, an excuse. And so I think that that's like a really big
minimize and
sorry.
And, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And some people, you know, come together and, or, or get it together and sort of realize what they do, and you kind of see it kind of unfold, like, in front of you, I think, a little bit, too.
Do you think that that was the most beneficial aspect of your sentencing?
Yeah. I think as, like, aspect of the sentencing. I do think that, like, the single most beneficial thing, though, was just being confronted with it. And just, I really mean this, and confessing to it. And I think, you know, there's a, again, I just don't want to understate how important I think confessions are to achieving justice, and how much our system doesn't care about them.
I think it's really valuable that you're saying that, because you've also explained how, in your particular case, the fact that you confessed, you know, caused you a lot of, like, personal difficulty, and because the legal process isn't set up to incentivize confessions, and so you personally were disadvantaged by the fact that you confessed. But you're still here saying that you think confessions are extremely important, and that mm-hmm. that and that the confession itself was beneficial to you.
Yeah, I mean, because the thing is, like I said, like, I've done everything that, like, I could have done, you know, to make the justice system work. From, you know, confession to completing my sentence, I sought out, you know, I went to, you know, that therapy. I sought out my own individual therapy, too. Like, I did everything that I could do. So it's like my conscience is clear. You know, there was nothing more that I could have done to, like, make this process smoother, you know, for everyone involved, and kind of just, like, not move past it, because that just means forgetting it, I think, but taking, like, the lesson as it comes. And so, yeah, it does. I just think that confessions are the place where you are going to start to see the kinds of emotional changes in people that you need, and that is for the assailant and the survivor. I would imagine, and I can only go off of, like, kind of stories I've heard, or, you know, victim testimony, but the confessions are also typically cathartic, it seems, for a survivor, and are, and when those are denied, it seems like another re-traumatizing of the person who already experienced assault. And so I think that we do a disservice to everyone by setting up this system that, in my view, punishes people not for the crimes that they did necessarily, but for the confession that they gave.
Yeah, that makes, you know,
lots of people do terrible things and don't confess, and then, you know, don't get punished for them. Like, nobody confesses to something and, you know, quote unquote, gets away with it.
Right. I know you have a lot of really important insight into the sex registry, and I'd like to save that for another talk. But one thing I wanted to touch on today is, you know, you mentioned that during your probation, you weren't allowed to drink alcohol, it sounds like, for 2 years. And
right.
So I was wondering if, I mean, I don't know if that applies to everyone on probation or whether or not alcohol was involved in your particular case, but, like, what are your thoughts on alcohol and sexual offenses or violent crimes?
Yeah, well, it was a factor in my case. Both, well, I was intoxicated during my offense, like, quite so. It was, like, 2:30 on, like, a Friday, you know? I mean, it was not a good situation. My victim was very drunk, more than me, in fact. And so the, which is common. mm-hmm. And I think the thing with alcohol, when I went back to school, I kind of had, like, this moment. I was in a criminology class, and I had this, I don't remember exactly what the professor was, like, a big lecture hall. And he said, he was kind of just walking up and down the aisles. He said, I want everybody to think about the worst thing that you have done since you have come to college? He's like, no one's going to be asked to share, but you have 30 seconds just to think about the worst thing that you've done. And I was like, well, I don't really need 30 seconds, but I'll take it. And at the end of 30 seconds, he's like, now, I just want you to raise your hand if when you did what you did, you were drunk or on alcohol specifically. And everyone that I could see, save one girl, raised their hand.
Wow.
Ugh. And yeah. And so like my first kind of question was actually, I was like, I mean, first of all, I was not surprised at all. But I like looked at this girl and I was just like, I wonder what she did. Like, that's what I wanted to know. Cause she's like the outlier. You know what I mean? I was like, wow. Like, I wonder what this girl did sober. Like, I wonder if it was like worse than like everybody else, you know, like I wonder if it was just like absolutely terrible. And so,
but yeah, that's, yeah. It sounds like
the thing is,
that's a pretty common denominator.
Yeah. And, but so alcohol, and it's not just sexual assaults. And, you know, I think that there's room here to say nobody ever deserves to be sexually assaulted. You know, nobody ever does. Right. It does not matter the conditions. Like, it doesn't matter what you're wearing. It doesn't matter how much you had to drink. It doesn't matter whatever. Nobody deserves to be violated in that way. And that's, you know, that is true. You know, that is just sort of like a moral maxim. Mm-hmm. It also happens to be true that a vast majority of violent crimes, not just sexual assault, all violent crimes, battery, you know, you like name one, you know, it's worse when alcohol is involved. And so I think that one thing that we need to be able to think about is balancing those two realities. You know, it can, I don't think that it can be as, you know, alcohol is not the problem with sexual assault, so therefore it's off the table. You know, it's a lot of different factors.
Yeah, I think the issue for me is like, how do you move sexual assault from a common experience to an uncommon experience?
Right.
Instead of what, some people are asking for, I think legitimately so, but I do think that it just becomes impractical at some point. It's going to be difficult to, you can't just say, well, there's this moral maxim, which is no one deserves to be raped, so everyone should stop it, because it's not going to get the job done. And I think that we can kind of slip into that absolutist mentality. And I think that that's a good thing. Like, I don't think that it's bad that is being advocated for, and just, you know, don't violate anyone ever is like something, you know, we should advocate for that. But if we're going to move it from a common experience to an uncommon experience first, I think that alcohol has to be on the table.
Yeah. And I don't know what the answer is either, because, you know, playing back in my own head, hearing this story, I've thought, you know, what are the worst things I've ever done? They involved alcohol. And it makes total sense to me that that would be a really common experience for these types of offenses. At the same time, I don't think, you know, I drink. I don't think that, you know, the prohibition should be reinstated or anything. But I do think that you're right in that this needs to be a part of the conversation. And
Yeah. And again, so one of like the arguments, you know, is that alcohol doesn't cause sexual assault, which is totally true. I mean, you can have like a part, like you can have a whole college house just filled to the brim with drunk people and no one gets assaulted, you know?
Right.
But what you can't have, well, I shouldn't say what you can't have, but like, we also have to acknowledge the fact that the vast majority of these violent crimes, including sexual assault, but not limited to sexual assault, you know, if you could just push a button for like a year, and just alcohol's off the table, you know, doesn't have to be like a criminal matter, you know, because that's what prohibition is, you know, you criminalize things. So I'm not for that. But I do think that we need to have some sort of like a cultural reckoning, you know, finding maybe just some different hobbies as like a society. And not to minimize, and I'm not really trying to minimize the seriousness of assault when it happens, but it's been such a huge issue for such a long time. I think that it's important to kind of keep in mind too that one of like the early feminist movements was temperance movement, and it was because, you know, all these husbands were going off to the bars and then coming home and beating up their wives, wasted. Mm-hmm. And they kind of blamed, you know, at the time, alcohol for that.
Right.
And so they went in this temperance movement. And it was like enormously successful, like the temperance movement. Prohibition was a failure, but like the political movement, I think that they just got misguided, because I think that what happened once it kind of percolated up through Congress to like amend the Constitution, it had become a criminal matter. And that is the way that our politicians and law enforcement learn to deal with these problems, is you just criminalize it and hopefully that makes it go away. But that's not what happens. And I don't think that that is what is going to be the solution for sexual assault either.
Right. I think that we have a lot of room to make progress with drinking, because I think that probably a lot of there's a reason why we hear about sexual assault on campuses so much. And, mm-hmm. you know, especially considering how related alcohol is to these offensive. I don't think that we, at least in America, are socially conditioned to drink responsibly at
right.
that youthful age, you know, because we have nothing, nothing, mm-hmm. nothing, nothing. And then suddenly, you know, if you have access to someone who can buy alcohol, or if you turn 21, then you have as much as you want. And mm-hmm. and I've thought for a long time that there's room for improvement in America when it comes to the way that we teach our children to view alcohol
mm-hmm.
and experience alcohol.
Right. Yeah, it's a really crazy drug, actually, and it's so normalized. And I, you know, and that just kind of is what it is. But
yeah,
I just don't think that there's like a legal. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, I think far fewer people assault others on marijuana. That
Absolutely.
Just for some reason seems less likely to me.
Right. And so, yeah, and it's not anti-alcohol, you know,
no.
And it's, you know, it's totally true that, you know, you can have a bunch of people and everybody drinks and like nothing bad happens. Like nobody does any crime. But it's also true that like when crime happens, that alcohol is a factor, you know, that needs to, we got to figure out a way to like, it's a balancing act. And I think that we, need to figure out a way to deal with that. And again, people taking accountability for what they do, you know, being drunk does not excuse you from anything either. It's not easy.
Yeah, it's not. And again, I don't have, you know, solutions in mind, but I do think that it's a part of the conversation that isn't always raised when talking about assault. So mm-hmm. I think it, you know, it deserves noting.
Mm-hmm.
So John, is there anything else? I do desperately actually want to ask for your opinions and personal experience regarding the sex registry, but we don't have time for that today. So that aside, mm-hmm. is there anything that you would like to address that I have neglected?
Well, I thought it'd be kind of fun.
Yeah.
Maybe fun's not the right word, but I wanted to read this passage out of this book.
Right.
That is actually a personal favorite of one of mine. I figured it out when I went back to school. It's called The Reader by Bernard Schlink. And he is he's a former judge in Germany and then turned sort of legal academic and literary guy. So he wrote this book called The Reader. And it's about this kid kind of has an affair with this woman and then later goes off to law school and is observing this trial. It turns out that this woman is on trial for basically being a Nazi, and she kind of does these crimes or whatever. And he is just kind of watching this criminal trial unfold. And, you know, he knew Hannah is her name personally, but was not aware of the crimes when they had an affair, even though it was already passed. And he's watching this trial unfold and being exposed to all of these terrible things that she did. And one of the chapters towards the end ends the following. I wanted simultaneously to understand Hannah's crime and to condemn it, but it was too terrible for that. When I tried to understand it, I had the feeling I was failing to condemn it as it must be condemned. When I condemned it as it must be condemned, there was no room for understanding. But even as I wanted to understand Hannah, failing to understand her meant betraying her all over again. I could not resolve this. I wanted to pose myself both tasks, understanding and condemnation, but it was impossible to do both. And so I think that what the author of this book is kind of getting at, I think that that is like the among the most serious, well, it's being presented here as a paradox between understanding and condemnation, that it was impossible to do both. And I think that we have to think about that and wonder, is that impossible? You know, what does it mean to understand somebody and condemn what they've done at the same time? I think that that is resolvable. And I think that we are a long way from resolving it yet. And then, you know, having that sort of manifest into our criminal justice system formally. But I think that that is the primary task of people who care about these issues, is how do you condemn the crimes that people commit and also understand how they got to that point in the first place, and whether or not, you know, we can do both, because I think that we can, but I don't think that most people agree with me.
Well, even if they agree with you theoretically, I think in practice it's a challenge for, you know, most everyone to do. But I think that you're right. I think that that's a really uncomfortable place to be in when you condemn and understand someone at the same time. But I can't imagine a greater place to come from when you are trying to determine the best course of action for dealing with traumatic issues.
Yep, it's really difficult. And I mean, I've got a lot more to say about it, so I probably should just cut her short before I go crazy. But yeah, and I think that that little uncomfortable spot is just so important. And one thing I personally think is really great about your podcast is I think you've kind of sort of doing like a little ballet, like on top of that needle point, like that awkward little spot of understanding and condemnation. And, you know, what the jurors are trying to do is understand and condemn at the same time. And what, you know, this is sort of testament to is just how difficult that is, just going round and round in circles, trying to figure out why somebody might have done something and to understand their positioning and then also condemning them for what they've done. And that is a huge intellectual chore for us. And I some days I don't think that we do a very good job.
Yeah. And just speaking about juries alone, I think you're right. I think that a lot of times juries are tasked with just making judgments based on the facts, and the facts alone. But the truth is, it's a very human and very personal and emotional experience. And you can't help as a human being but try to empathize with either the victim or the defendant. And so that's when things get hazy in jury rooms, you know, when that human component comes in. Because I have a lot of problems with the jury system, but I feel like, you know, we shouldn't be instructing them to disregard their humanity. At the same time, it's impossible to because possibly it's impossible to expect them to do that.
Yeah, it's really difficult. There's no like obvious solutions to a lot of these things, but I think that there's a lot of obvious problems.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's where I keep coming down recently. It's like, I don't want to be the asshole that's just pointing out all of the flaws. You know, like I don't always have solutions at the ready, but
that is so true. And I think that that's another like critical thing. And maybe we'll like end with this, I guess. But I do think that there is a sort of lack of imagination sometimes that comes down to how we deal with the criminal justice system. You know, there's a lot of different ways that this could unfold. And, you know, we do need to come up with solutions to these problems. And to do that, we need to start imagining, you know, what the system could be like instead of just taking for granted what it is.
Yeah. And without the constraint of the precedent that's been set.
Yeah. Yeah. History is like, you know, well, you know, our Constitution is extremely old. actually, for like a legal document. It's kind of insane, I think, too. And we are operating on like legal precedent that way even outdates, you know, a legal kind of culture that way outdates the Constitution even.
Yeah, well, it's funny because I did some research into legal processes when I started the podcast, and a lot of things I wanted to like find out, well, why is it this way? You know, like, why are there 12 members on a jury? And what a lot of it comes down to is English common law, meaning America just took whatever England was doing, and we just did that too. But no one can trace back why it started, that why that was the precedent set in the first place in England.
And so we're really, our legal system is very committed, is very constricted by its history. And like on purpose too, you know, it's like when they, you know, the Supreme Court and like the whole judicial branch operates on precedents, for the most part. And so, very constrained by history. And I think that, we need to, first we need to imagine a way that it could be better for everyone. And, you know, then the real, you know, you have to imagine what it could be like, and then you have to do the chore of actually activating, you know, the political system to get what you want. Yeah. And so those are two very big tasks.
But I think that's a really important excerpt from the book that you read. And I think it's a really, the idea of opening our imaginations to a better experience is a great closing thought. Can you give us the name of that book again?
It is The Reader by Bernard Schlink.
Okay, The Reader. I definitely need to read that.
Yeah, you definitely do.
Thanks to John for being so great as to share his personal experience with us on such a sensitive topic. If more people spoke openly like this, I think we'd stand a greater chance of finding a place of mutual understanding and diminishing the number of sexual assaults in our country. In 2 days, the trial of Keith Montgomery continues, in which we finish the conversation about statement analysis and explore some of the struggles by which public defenders are burdened. See you in 2 days.